The 12th, I'm Lori London in Washington. Lots of news to get to today. The United States commemorated the 18th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks Wednesday with ceremonies at the three crash sites in New York City, the Pentagon, and Arlington in Arlington and Virginia and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. In his remarks at the Pentagon, President Trump praised first responders, but also reignited controversy about where he was on the day of the attacks. White House correspondent Patsy Witakuswara has this report.
President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump laid a wreath at the Pentagon in remembrance of the victims of the September 11th attacks.
God bless America.
To each of you, the First Lady and I are united with you in grief.
Vice President Mike Pence was in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, honoring the passengers and crew of Flight 93 who fought the terrorists and brought down the plane that was headed to the White House.
But America took the fight back to our enemies on that very same day. Not on some foreign battlefield, but right here.
Oh, say can you see?
Remembrance ceremonies were also held in New York, where the two planes brought down the Twin Towers 18 years ago. But during his remarks praising first responders, the president reignited an old controversy about what he did on the day of the attack.
Soon after, I went down to Ground Zero with men who worked for me to try to help in any little way that we could.
Trump has often claimed he was at Ground Zero on 9/11 alongside firefighters and police officers, but first responders have disputed the account. During his campaign in 2015, Trump also falsely claimed that thousands of people were cheering in New Jersey as the buildings were coming down, referring to what he calls the heavy Arab population in the state.
They recognized that some people did something.
In April, he used videos of 9/11 to denounce Democratic House member Ilhan Omar for remarks she made during a speech on civil rights and Muslims in America, which her critics say downplayed the 9/11 attacks. In July, Trump signed the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, a bipartisan law to continue to provide compensation for individuals who suffered physical harm or later died as a result of 9/11. Patsy Witakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
With former Ambassador John Bolton out as U.S. National Security Advisor at a time when there are a host of serious issues around the world still, there are questions about what the priorities are for the U.S. national security. Joining us is Dr. Bill Parker, CEO and President of the East-West Institute. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Parker. Are you at all concerned about the turnover in the Trump administration with this latest departure of a third national security advisor?
I think change within the administration is something that U.S. government officials know how to deal with, whether they're military or others. I think the bigger concern and challenge that we have is whether or not there's a consistent message outside of the United States. When you talk to our friends, allies, and potential adversaries, and they look at who is speaking for the United States, is it the president? Is it the National Security Advisor? Is it the Congress? And if you have a consistent turnover, that becomes a challenge. If you're dealing with China, you're dealing with Xi Jinping. If you're dealing with Russia, you're dealing with Putin. And what they say is all-powerful and almighty. Whether they're considered emperors and a czar or whether they're considered a president is up for debate. But the reality is they speak for their country. The reality with the United States, because of the way our government is set up and the many changes that we've had in this particular administration, it's hard to tell sometimes who is actually speaking for the government on a day-to-day basis.
With so many hotbed issues around the world, we've got North Korea launching missiles, Iran nuclear ambitions. We've got Russia. And I understand that you've been to many of these places recently working on these very issues. What are you able to tell us about what you're seeing and hearing?
As I come back from Russia, Turkey, those areas, China, Armenia, Russia, et cetera, and I look at these various areas, the one consistent message that I'm starting to hear is the, quote, New World Order. And this New World Order appears to be Russia, China, and those countries that are disenfranchised with the West, not just the United States, but the West in general. And so where does that go? Where does India play into this? Where do other countries that are on the border right now play into this? So this is a major concern as we move forward on how we deal with this carefully. That said, I do believe that the United States does a very good job, despite what you see in the media a lot of times. We do a very good job as a nation of using all the instruments of national power in order to influence the rest of the world. And that doesn't necessarily mean military. It means all those other instruments.
When you say that there's a new world order, can you be more specific about what that actually means and looks like?
And I want to be very careful here. I am not saying that I think there's a new world order. I'm saying that there is a group of people out there, whether they're Russians, Chinese, and others, who are saying right now that a new world order is forming. And that new world order will look something like an alignment with the Russians and the Chinese and those countries that are disenfranchised with the West. Now, you only need to look back a few weeks when you see the Russians and the Chinese for the first time flying strategic bombers through the Sea of Japan and around the Sea of Japan together in a combined operation. They're doing combined military operations right now, and they're also working closely together economically. Their equivalent of Davos in Russia just happened a couple weeks ago. And during that, for the first time, you heard Xi Jinping stand up and say, the Russians and the Chinese in our entire world history have never been closer.
Interesting. And the things that you have been hearing and discussing, what are some of your biggest concerns?
Well, first of all, I will say that the vast majority of the world still thirsts to be like the United States. In other words, they still thirst for a marketplace economy, freedom of speech, freedom to practice your religion as you want to, freedom to marry who you want to. Those things are still thirsted by most of the population of the world, so make that very clear. But what you are starting to see is some confusion, and this really has been going on for about a decade now, of what messaging is coming out of the United States, and is there a consistent message of things like JCPOA when we're working with the Iranians, of whether or not we are going to continue to support NATO the way we did before, or whether NATO is stronger now than it used to be because we're requiring people to contribute beyond the massive contributions that have been going on from the United States for so long. So there are inconsistencies in that message. The one thing that I do find interesting is the messaging that you see on media, especially on television overseas. I think that the United States' message does not always get out in the most positive light when you see television overseas. And this is where organizations like Voice of America do a good job of being able to put out exactly what is going on in the United States and how we impact the rest of the globe.
All right. That is Dr. Bill Parker. He is the CEO and president of the East-West Institute. We thank you so much for being with us. Three top aides to former National Security Advisor John Bolton have submitted their resignations a day after Bolton and President Trump parted ways. It comes as talk of how Bolton's departure went down and who might replace him. Joining us to talk more about that, Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. So what is your overall sense of what has happened in the past 48 hours?
I talked to colleagues when he was chosen, and a number of us expressed surprise because he's quite combative. He's a very prickly personality. We wondered how a person like that would get along with somebody like Mr. Trump, who demands kind of obedience and subservience and so forth. Apparently, they got along reasonably well until the end. It doesn't surprise me that there's a dispute between the two as to whether he resigned or was fired. And I find it interesting that so much time is being spent on this issue. You know, it doesn't matter. What does matter, I think, is that Mr. Bolton would not stroke the president's ego in the way in which the president insists.
Are you saying, meaning just go along with his positions?
Yes. Mr. Trump at some point recently was quoted as saying, I like people to argue with me, something to that effect. And that may be true. I don't know one way or the other. But I certainly liked that when I was leading a department. But once a decision was made, I didn't expect people to disagree to sort of go out to the press. And I think Mr. Bolton's mistake was he could disagree with the president, but at the end of the day, when the president made a decision, the president expected him to say, yes, sir, I'm with the program. Instead, from what one reads in the press, he would immediately try to undermine whatever decision the president had made. And that's intolerable. Whether you agree with Mr. Trump or not, that's intolerable. There is only one head of whatever, whether it's the president or a department head or something, there's only one of them. And once that person has made a decision, to my mind, you either go along with it or you resign. You don't sneak out of the room and start calling your friends in the press, or much worse, calling people on Capitol Hill to try to undermine the president's position.
Is it well known that that was, in fact, what was happening?
I think so, yes.
Their philosophies are very different as far as Trump not wanting to get involved and getting out of a lot of conflicts. Bolton had a completely different view. He wanted to demolish North Korea and others. He's somewhat of a hawk. Do you think when it came to the president's desire to have the Taliban come to Camp David for talks was, in Bolton's case, probably a good idea, particularly the week of 9/11?
I thought it was a terrible idea. The Taliban is a terrorist organization. At best, you invite them to the United States to conduct discussions at the State Department. You don't take them up to the cozy haven of Camp David, which, as you know, under President Roosevelt, was called Shangri-La. You don't do that with your enemy. Mr. Trump likes strong men. We know he's has kind of a bromance with Mr. Putin. He seemed to admire Mr. Kim of North Korea. And I think what he liked about Bolton, the attraction was, Bolton is known as a tough guy, a hawk, you know, doesn't take any crap from anybody. And I think the president liked that. But when push came to shove, when it came to actually following those impulses and doing something like sending missiles into Iran because of the shoot down of the drone, when it came to that, the president isn't that hawkish. And I think it's in part because he admired that in Bolton until it came time to actually do something. And that's because I think the president often doesn't know what he wants, and what he wants now may well be different from what he wants in 5 minutes.
There's a lot of confusion, I would imagine, about who the president brings on as his next national security advisor and if that person will have any sway as an advisor, which seems like the president is more inclined to like to have people around him that agree with him.
Yes, the traditional role of the national security advisor was to be an honest broker, bringing forth in a neutral, honest way the views of CIA, state, DOD, and depending on the issue, Treasury, and so forth. And then he would kind of put those positions together and present them to the president, and then there'd be a principals meeting. Mr. Bolton did not act in that role at all. In fact, he probably acted less like a national security advisor than any other person who's held that position. He did not put differing views in front of the president. He didn't try to be an honest broker of differing opinions and so forth. So he was not good at what he was supposed to be doing. I don't think it matters who is chosen. I think what will matter to Mr. Trump is, will this guy agree with me, salute, and go out the door and do what I want, but maybe hold back just a little bit in case I change my mind. And I don't think foreign leaders and ambassadors are likely to take whoever this person is terribly seriously.
Would that be a problem?
It is a problem to have a national security advisor whom foreign leaders and emissaries don't take seriously because they can't take him or her seriously because of how the president uses that person.
All right, that is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The Bahamas officials now say 2,500 people are listed as missing in the wake of Hurricane Dorian. UN experts are calling for repatriation of ISIS-linked children and mothers in Syria. The U.S. Supreme Court allows broad enforcement of asylum limits, and a Chinese woman has been found guilty of trespassing at a Trump resort. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Plan to crack down on electronic cigarettes was announced in the White House Oval Office Wednesday. The move comes after at least six people died and hundreds more nationwide have been sickened in the past few months by mysterious illnesses linked to vaping. We have details now from VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
President Donald Trump, while noting that the alternative to conventional cigarettes has become a multi-billion dollar business, said it is time to confront the health problems it is causing.
We can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected.
Regulations are being created that would remove from the market most of the flavored pods for e-cigarettes that are attracting teenagers. The U.S. government, however, intends to allow tobacco flavors to remain as an alternative for conventional cigarette smokers. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
And you are listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. For the first time in centuries, a large whale species may go extinct in the Atlantic Ocean. Since 2017, 28 North Atlantic right whales have died in U.S. and Canadian waters, including eight just this past summer. There are only about 400 of the animals remaining and fewer than 100 breeding females. About 83% of all right whales have been entangled at least once in the roughly 1 million lines of fishing gear that extends across their migration routes and feeding areas in the U.S. and Canada. The environmental ocean protection group Oceana is launching a bi-national campaign in the U.S. and Canada now to help save this species. It's just published a report detailing the dire situation these whales face and what must be done to save them before it's too late. Joining us is Whitney Weber, Oceana's campaign director, here to talk about this latest campaign to save these iconic creatures. Fill us in on what is at issue.
Well, this is a whale that migrates along the eastern seaboard from Florida all the way up to Canada and back down again. So they are focused on the east coast, but there are only about 400 of these animals left. We had decimated their population before a ban on whaling was put on in the 30s, and they have slowly crept back up, and now we're seeing a very, very dramatic decline in deaths. In the past 3 years, we've seen eight deaths alone this year, and for a population of that size, it's quite dramatic and alarming.
Why is this happening?
Primarily, it's the whales are unpredictable. They are moving into areas that they haven't typically been before. We speculate that that is primarily due to their shifting food source that is trying to find colder waters up in Canada. And so the whales are oftentimes adding up to 750 extra miles to their migration routes to try and find their food. You know, in the meantime, they're getting exposed to additional fisheries and very busy shipping channels up there. So it's certainly becoming quite apparent that something needs to be done aggressively binationally.
And what is your plan of action for this?
Well, Oceana's jumping in now. We're joining the fight that several have been in for a while because we have an office in Canada, which is kind of unique. So we plan to work with our colleagues across country lines to help come up with solutions. We also, you know, are very campaign focused in that we have expertise at the grassroots level. We have grassroots folks all along the eastern seaboard of the U.S. We have a marketing and communications department. We have a legal arm. We have our advocacy folks that have relationships with government officials. And we plan to use all of those arms to help press on the leverage points to get things done and move the needle in the right direction.
The fishing nets and the ships that are striking these animals, these industries, is there a specific aim at really getting them to be aware of what they're doing out there? And are you, and if so, have you had receptiveness from those industries?
Awareness has been raising steadily in the industries that are impacted. With the 8 whale deaths this year alone, it's been very alarming for everyone involved and trying to come up with solutions. We really feel that the immediate solutions are reducing the amount of lines in the water. So these fisheries that use these traps or pots that sit on the bottom of the ocean floor are attached to a buoy by a very strong rope vertical line. The whales can't see them. There are roughly a million of them sprawled across their migration route, and so it's a minefield out there for them. They're just getting entangled in these ropes. So if we can reduce the amount of ropes in the water, that will have a very immediate impact. And then science has found if we reduce and enforce a 10-knot speed restriction on ships, that actually decreases the risk of right whale collision by 86%. So let's get some mandatory speed restrictions in the areas where these whales are showing up.
What can you tell us about these whales?
What's really interesting about them is because there are so few of them left, we actually have a catalog of each individual that we know of.
Hmm.
So some of them have names. Many of them have families. And we highlight in our report one of them, Punctuation, was a prolific grandmother who we had started sighting about 38 years ago. She produced many calves, survived many fishing entanglements, a couple different ship strikes, but couldn't fight it through this year. She was hit by a ship in June of this year and didn't make it. These are the third biggest whale we have. They are very much have complex nervous systems, much like we do, and they are dying some very painful, horrible deaths, and we really need to stop that trend from happening. If we don't take some pretty serious, aggressive action now, the species could be functionally extinct in the next few decades, which would make it the first large whale species in the Atlantic Ocean to go extinct in centuries.
All right, Whitney Weber, she is the campaign director for Oceana. Thank you for being with us. Well, facing growing competition from less expensive smartphone providers, Apple introduced its versions of its iconic iPhone Tuesday at its annual product launch event in California. Along with the latest upgrades and offerings, Apple caught the attention of consumers and critics for something it didn't do. VOA's Richard Green has more on the tech giant's newest strategy.
For our customers that want the most sophisticated technology that really pushes the limits, we've created something truly special. And I'm thrilled to introduce it to you now.
At the company's headquarters in Cupertino, California, Apple Chief Executive Officer Tim Cook announced that the new versions of the groundbreaking iPhone, dubbed the iPhone 11 Pro and the iPhone 11 Pro Max, now have a third camera lens that brings them up to par with the cameras on rival smartphones from Samsung and Huawei.
With these three cameras, you have incredible creative control. So, for example, you can use the telephoto and get in close on your subject to really zoom in on it. Or you can use the wide to tell a bit more of a story. Or you can pull all the way out to the ultra wide and reveal the full surroundings.
But in a surprise move, Apple set the price of its entry-level iPhone 11 at $700, compared to the $750 price tag on last year's iPhone XR, and much less than the $1,000 and up set for the two advanced iPhone 11s. The price cut reflects the recent trend among consumers to hold on to their current phones well after new, more expensive versions are introduced.
you have people that sunk in $1,000 for a phone. They're not going to buy for another 2-3 years, probably. So it's always difficult. This is about capturing more of the older generation device owners, and also capturing more people from outside the iOS ecosystem.
Starting today,
CEO Tim Cook also said that anyone who buys the new iPhones or the upgraded iPad handheld computer will receive a free 1-year subscription to the new Apple TV Plus video streaming service, which begins on November 1st.
These are just a few of the exclusive...
Apple says the new service, which will showcase original dramas, comedies, and other content, will be offered to new subscribers at just $5 a month, putting it in direct competition to Netflix and other streaming video services. The new iPhones, along with the upgraded versions of its iPad and Apple Watch, will go on sale on September 20th. Richard Green, VOA News, Washington.
Well, oil tycoon, legendary oil tycoon T. Boone Pickens has died at his Dallas home at the age of 91. We get more now from Jennifer King.
T. Boone Pickens was born in a small town in Oklahoma and followed his father into the oil and gas business at Phillips Petroleum. He soon formed his own company and made millions as he burnished an image as a maverick. In the 1980s, he became known as a corporate raider, making billions using his company, Mesa Petroleum, to launch hostile corporate takeover bids. Later in his career, Pickens championed renewable energy, including wind power, taking out ads like this one in 2008.
I've been an oil man my whole life, but this is one emergency we can't drill our way out of.
Pickens made huge donations to University of Texas hospitals and his alma mater, Oklahoma State University. He suffered a series of strokes in 2017 and was hospitalized that year. A family spokesman says Pickens passed away under hospice care at his Dallas home. I'm Jennifer King.
The new movie Hustlers is bringing Jennifer Lopez some of the best reviews of her career for her role as Ramona, a veteran New York stripper who organizes a scam to drug guys from Wall Street and max out their credit cards. She talked to Variety about what it took to identify with her character and about learning how to pole dance.
That steel pole is unforgiving, and you just have to figure it out. And even my teacher, who's more of a Cirque du Soleil acrobatic pole dancer, is like, this is all normal. And I was like, this is chafing is normal.
Based on a true story, critics say it is not just a flashy film about strippers, but also an empowering feminist tale about the sisterhood of women who turn the tables on a male-dominated industry. With this fall's awards season just around the corner, Lopez's performance is creating a lot of buzz. She just turned 50 in July and says an Oscar would be a very tremendous moment in her life. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
This is VOA News.